Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is the bit where we test the levels, and I thought it was going to be great this week because they've just released the best jokes from the Edinburgh Fringe, allegedly, and most of them are rubbish. Ivo Graham has come up with quite a good one, because he's Ivo Graham is a posh boy, you know that, you've seen him.
He went to York Uni there, didn't he?
No, he went to either Cambridge or Oxford.
Oh, did he? I thought that he was one of the ones who was one of these posh boys who then didn't go to...
No.
Who, like, refused an offer to Oxford or Cambridge. Who did that, a comedian?
Pretty sure Ivo went to Oxford or Cambridge, but you might be right.
No, I'm probably not. I thought you'd told me that, so if you don't think that's right, then
no.
I'm wrong.
However, his Edinburgh joke was, I've got an Eton-themed... Because he definitely went to Eton. So he says he's got an Eton theme to his advent calendar, where all the doors are opened for me by my dad's contacts.
That's really good.
That's good. But the other joke's not that great. A thesaurus, this is Ross Smith, who's quite a well-known stand-up, I think. He says, a thesaurus is great. There's no other word for it. Olaf Falafel, who we've featured before in this highly prestigious Testing the Levels spot, Olaf Falafel came up, his joke was, I keep randomly shouting out broccoli and cauliflower. I think I might have florets. And
that's pretty decent, I think.
Well, there's been a, you know,
a bit of a backlash against it
because of the Tourette's Society.
Yeah. Well, Tourette's is one of those things that people continue to sort of take the piss out of when it is a mental illness. And
It's not just swearing, is it?
It's a lot of it is like jitters or twitches and stuff. Billie Eilish has Tourette's.
Really?
She had a twitch or something.
So one of my Twitter people, one of my what you call cronies, said to me, they've asked me to do some charity work for the brittle bone syndrome people. And the guys pay me £25 an hour and I get weekends off. I snapped his hand off, which is sort of the same thing you would get.
But, like, I don't think Tourette's is something that, like, truly does affect people and is really difficult to overcome a lot of times, whereas brittle bones is not.
Right.
Also, so barely anyone.
The brittle bone people, they're okay. They're
also, who has brittle bones anymore?
Well, from, like, people with brittle bone syndrome. Oh, well, old people, so that's okay.
No, I'm just saying, like, it's like not... A lot of people used to have brittle bone syndrome, but I think... Hasn't that, like, sort of been a bit one of those things like TB?
Possibly.
Rickets.
Yeah.
People just don't have rickets as much anymore. So there was a teacher at my school who was the... I don't know what he did. He's like maybe the caretaker or something, and he had rickets. He went on a school trip with us.
Really? It's what exactly is rickets? That's sort of like
it's
a
where your
bone
arms.
Thing.
Your, wait, not your arms. Your legs. Your other arms. Your bottom arms. They. I'm doing a gesture. It's like they curve.
They curve. Yeah.
They curve outwards.
Good, we've dealt with rickets. You've got a lot going on in your life at the moment, a hell of a lot, because you've had your A-level results, which I did put on Twitter, not in an...
Oh, did you? I didn't even see.
Yes, well, I didn't... I knew you wouldn't want me to sort of do the whole proud dad.
No, I hate that.
Yeah, so do I.
So annoying.
The people on Facebook, oh, haven't they done well and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So I didn't do any of that, but I did put a mention just for people. I was asked, basically, somebody tweeted and said, what was Ruth's A-level results? So I put them on Twitter.
You put my actual what I got?
Two A's and a B.
Yeah, I know, but I didn't want you to put what I actually got on Twitter.
What did you? Oh, did you want me to put three A stars?
No, I didn't know. Not what I didn't mean. What I actually got. You could have just been like, "Oh, she did fine."
Oh, no, they wanted... Well, people asked, what did you get? And you got two A's and a B, so well done. Because A star is sort of showing off a bit, isn't it?
Exactly.
Isn't it?
Like, I don't... You know.
Who needs A stars?
Who? You know?
Who needs A levels? Because in a few years' time...
That's nobody... what Jeremy Clarkson, he always says, I got... A C and two U's, look at me now. Yeah, that's what he always does.
Well, there was
tweet
a lot
like
of that on A level result day, and that's worse. That's the worst.
It's also completely stupid. Like, no one's going to feel better by Jeremy Clarkson saying, look at my mansion, and I got this.
So, you got your A level results, they were fine, they were more or less what you wanted, but you'd already got an unconditional offer anyway, so even if you'd have failed them, you'd have had your university place. You're going to Leeds Fest tomorrow?
Yes. I'm going for the weekend, so to see lots of people. I'm really excited to see Slur Tie.
And we played them on the podcast.
Yeah. Glastonbury looks amazing. Like, compared to the amount of people that are there. Miley Cyrus was at Glastonbury.
Glastonbury seems to me to be less for hardcore musos than the Leeds Fest.
I feel like Leeds Fest is more for if you're local and you want a big party, whereas Glastonbury seems like if you want a proper festival. Do you know what I mean?
No, what I think, if ABBA were to reform, they would play Glastonbury. They would be the main act at Glastonbury, whereas they wouldn't be at Leeds Fest or Reading Fest, because their history is they were rock festivals originally.
Well, a lot of people, it's within sort of the last 4 years that there's been more kind of rap and hip-hop and more mainstream stuff, and there was quite a lot of like backlash last year from people who've been going for years and years, saying it's got too mainstream, you know, because like Dua Lipa was there last year, you can't get more mainstream than Dua Lipa, and a lot of people were saying you've sort of kind of sold out for what people want.
But bands like
in
Muse
fairness,
and Kasabian, U2, that's what
because Muse were there 1 year, but then like Kings of Leon were there last year and they were awful. Like, I cannot describe how boring. I hope Kings of Leon aren't listening, but they were so boring.
Do you know, and they're regular subscribers to the podcast, Kings of Leon, they absolutely love it.
But the main like audience for them are like 16 to sort of 19-year-olds, so why would they not be playing stuff that, you know, you've got, I think you've got to cater to an audience. You can't just keep everything the same because that's the way it was.
This unconditional offer that you've got at York University is quite controversial. Labour have come out with their plans if they were to get into government. Students would apply to university only after receiving their A-level results under Labour proposals. The party said that it would abolish the system of predicted A-level grades determining university offers and end the summer clearing scramble, which some of your friends must be involved in. The move would also end unconditional offers, in which universities offer places to students with no A-level grades required. Head teachers have said that these are damaging education. Angela Rayner, the shadow education, said predicted grades were, quote, wrong in the vast majority of cases, and that disadvantaged students in particular lost out under the system.
Yeah.
So sounded to me fully sensible. That sounded to me as
it is, but then also how there's just not enough time between when you get your results and when you go to university to find for everyone to have university places and stuff like.
So is that impractical what they're saying? Because it does
maybe,
sound sensible.
I mean, I don't know how it would work, but maybe. You know what I would also say? I don't really care anymore.
No, of course you don't. You've got a place.
Yeah.
But I mean, you were disappointed with some of your predicted grades because I went to that
In the end, I wasn't, because I thought I was going to get I would have got predicted exactly what I got, so they were probably right. But I said that I think I could get an A in English, which I didn't. I got a B. And they said...
So they were right and you were wrong, really?
Oh, yeah, entirely. Yeah. But I wanted 3 years to be able to apply to wherever I wanted to go.
And the unconditional offer thing, do you think that's right or wrong? I mean, it's not stopped you working. You can't be working.
No, but I do think the unconditional offer thing is kind of wrong. But they do it for, like, so I had 3 out of 5 of my offers were unconditionals because I was doing languages. And if you're doing a course that not many people do and they really want to get people into, they offer you unconditionals so to make sure you go.
Yeah.
Because the universities can't fill the places.
Now, it means that we only have a few weeks left with you living in our house. About 6 weeks left, because you go at the end of September, don't you, to university. I'm looking at it with trepidation, because it's the first time we'll have had an empty house. So
empty nest.
We are empty nesters. However, I read this piece by the science correspondent at the Times, and it says, empty nesters rejoice. Scientists have found that having children makes you happier. but only after they've left home. Parenthood can involve less free time, less rest. And
oh, come no.
Are you just agreeing with the time of science correspondent?
Yeah.
Parenthood can involve less free time, less rest, and less money to spare. And previous research has shown that those without children tended to be happier. Now, however, a large study has indicated that parents with grown-up offspring who've moved out of the family home are more contented. The headline was, "Children really do make you happier, but only after they've gone." It was German researchers.
But then the stuff they're saying that makes you unhappy doesn't... Like, I think there's two levels to happiness. There's, like, general happiness, as in sort of being well-rested and having enough money and all that kind of stuff. But then your overall sort of fulfilment in life, having little kids, surely that makes you happier.
Well, I'm trying to think back.
Do you know what I mean? Like, obviously there's a lack of rest and you've not been able to go out all the time and you can't go on benders or whatever. But the overall fulfilment for having raised children, if you want them, I'm not saying that everyone should want children, but I don't think that those things make you less happy. Maybe make you less happy in a day-to-day thing if you're tired and frustrated, but not less fulfilled.
Well, the Germans disagree
with
you.
Well, what do the Germans know?
German researchers analysed questionnaires from 55,000 respondents aged 50 or above from 16 European countries.
I know better. I've not had kids.
No, well, precisely.
I was one, though.
Well, you were, and so was I. 16 European countries were questioned on this, and they were asked about mental health, sense of well-being, family and social life. Those with children tend to be more content, but only if those children had moved out. Having them at home was linked to a lower quality of life.
Yeah, quality of life, but I don't think quality of life necessarily links directly to happiness.
Yeah, well, I'm with you on that. For a start, and what we're going to talk about when you're gone. We'll talk about whether you phoned or not.
Whether I phoned or not. And the answer is always no, she's not phoned.
No, you're not great on the phone.
I'm rubbish. Yeah. I ring to make sure you know I'm okay, but sometimes I'll just text saying I'll be home.
Sometimes. You know, you said, you know, you get children at home, you can't go out on a bender. Well, we do, because in my guide to bad parenting, that's one of the prime things that you do.
Oh, you go out?
Go out on a bender. Because if you're not there, you don't know that we're going out on a bender.
Yeah, true. Is that why you're so keen on me, like, going out and staying at friends' houses? Is this because you and Mum are out all the time?
Let's have another pint. I wonder if you've ever read The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank. Did you ever read it?
Yeah, of course I've read it.
Every child... Did you do it at school or did you
I read it at home. I just have it at home. I've read it a couple of times, actually. Yeah. I read it mainly because I was such a massive fan of Jacqueline Wilson. You know, I completely idolised her. And in her diary, it's called My Secret Diary.
Yes, that's right.
She talks about how she absolutely adored The Diary of Anne Frank, and she had a picture of Anne Frank like on her bedside table, and she used to read it over and over and over again. So then just after I'd read that, I read The Diary of a Young Girl.
So you would have read it when you were about the age that she was, what, 13, 14?
I read it, I think, when I was about 12.
Yeah, and she'd have been about 13 or 14, yeah. I think, when she
I read
wrote
it when
it.
I was just slightly younger than when she wrote it, but yeah.
What did you make of it? What did you take from it?
Oh, I thought it was beautiful and so sad. When I read it when I was 12, I thought, oh, yeah, right, okay. But I don't think I really appreciated it as much. And then I read it when I was about 15 or 16, and I really appreciated it a lot more then. Firstly, because I knew a lot more about the Holocaust. And also, I've appreciated what a brilliant writer she was as well.
Yes.
Which is the unbelievable thing. So I've read the Malala Yousafzai, who is an unbelievable girl, and she won the Nobel Peace Prize and is amazing.
What's her book called?
Her book is called I Am Malala. So I read that one as well. And as much as it was a fantastic story, it got kind of compared a bit to the... Which I don't think you should have compared it, but it did at the time. I think what you saw in hers was that she wasn't as a natural writer in the way that Anne Frank was.
Yeah, because Anne Frank wrote other stuff as well. The only reason I know all about this and I'm asking about this is there's a new book out called The Collected Works of Anne Frank, which is reviewed in this week's Times Literary Supplement. Not that I ever buy the Times Literary Supplement, but now there's one of the few perks of us moving buildings at Talk Radio is that we're right next door. The office next door is the office of the Times Literary Supplement. Mm. They're on the same floor as us. I suspect that was the worst floor you could get put on, right next to Talk Radio. So you've got Talk Radio, people shouting all the time and talking nonsense, and then people very quietly at their desks at the Times Literary Supplement, you know, reviewing books. But they review the Anne Frank book here.
Wait, they review there's a new book coming out that's The Collected Works. What other stuff has it got in it?
Well, what it's got in it is other bits of essays and things that she wrote.
Oh, right.
As well as
I didn't know there was anything else.
Yeah, she did write other stuff. It's looking at Anne Frank as a writer. Mm. And it's sort of saying that the message that people take from Anne Frank is sort of wrong. What they're saying is that people take this uplift, because it was made into a film, and before that it was a play. It was a stage play.
I went to see the play.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the stage play that made it very famous.
Yeah.
You know,
I went to see it because when I was in a production of Annie when I was a kid. I always make you laugh when I say when I was a kid, because you say you're still a kid. But when I was a little kid, the woman who played Miss Hannigan played Anne Frank's mum.
Mm. Well, people, what they're saying in this article is that people take the wrong message from, because it was a stage play and it was a Hollywood film, that they've taken the end of the book to be, which is the end of the play, to be an uplifting message.
I didn't find it uplifting, the book.
Didn't you?
No.
Well, you've read it the right way then. It says, in spite of everything, this was the last words, weren't they? In spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. Thus, the story that would end in Anne's squalid death was given an uplifting Hollywood ending. So it's sort of like given an uplifting ending. But a little bit before that, she has a very much darker view of humanity. I don't believe the war is simply the work of politicians or capitalists. Oh no, the common man is every bit as guilty.
Mm. I think both of those things can be true. So, mm-hmm. Do you know, I think it can be both despairing and uplifting at the same time. I think that those things can coexist. But I also think that that's what people forget as they're reading it, is that she's a teenage girl. And I think that when you're a teenager, you can believe lots of things all at once, because you're discovering what your worldview is. And that's why it's so hopeless, is that she never did get to decide what she thought of the world.
See, I think the other thing it's saying in this review is that she's been made into a saint, because Jews don't have saints, but the Mormons have adopted her, and she's been made... There are other...
If you go to the Anne Frank Museum, the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam, which I really wanted to go to, and I went with Mum.
No wonder the Nazis found her, because there's signs all over
everywhere.
Amsterdam.
Anne Frank House.
Anne Frank House, very easy to find.
They do. There was one bit that I was like, oh, that is... Because I kind of felt it was sort of a bit weird. I always find these things with Holocaust memorials and the museums.
Yeah. I think we've talked about this.
They don't sit right with me at all. But when I went to see it, one of the things, and people try and ignore it, is that she had this really like flirty relationship with the boy. I can't remember what his name was now.
No, it's in here somewhere.
Something like Lancelot. It's something Dutch. She had this really like flirty relationship with her, and one of the diaries they cut out a lot of the stuff where she's talking about like sex and stuff, but she was like 13 or 14. That is part of it, and it's part of when people cut that out, is erasing her as a real person. Mm. I think one of the really interesting things about it is that people romanticise this idea of just this like little found diary and how amazing it was and stuff. But they listened to a pirate radio station when they were in the attic.
Well, listen to the BBC.
Yeah, or the BBC or whatever. And the BBC said, if you're hiding somewhere, and write a diary, keep the diary, go back through it, because will want to publish these diaries afterwards. And she heard it, and she went back through old entries of her diary and made them better. She edited. She was her own editor. And I think that makes it an even more brilliant story, is that she was aware of it, and she knew that she knew what she had to say was...
But it was ages
worthy.
Before it was published. It was 50s before.
Yeah, yeah, because her dad found it.
He was given it by Meep.
Yes.
Meep, I always think, is the hero of the story. Mm. It's one of the helpers who kept it.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic story.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We very rarely talk about Brexit, but you said you have
I have some stuff about Brexit. I read an interesting article on the in The Guardian.
Guardian, obviously.
Obviously, because it's free. And I'm not going to pay for my press. They're just this, basically, I read it and I was like, gosh, I really do not know what I think about that. So he was basically saying...
The Guardian normally tell you what to think, because you normally come here with a full set of Guardian attitudes. We did talk about this last week, the fact that because you get all your information off The Guardian, and you do that because it's free for no other reason, The Guardian is now moulding a generation of young minds.
I also do it because their website is really user-friendly.
Mm, yeah, precisely.
Which is... Well done there.
Yeah. Well, you see, the mail, that's free, but it's the website.
The website's crap.
Yeah.
It's so difficult to navigate.
Yes, it is.
Whereas The Guardian is all nice colours as well.
Mm, lovely. So,
So this guy, and he was talking about how he thinks that it's already, we've already screwed everything up, basically, and that there's no way to go back from it, and that everyone is becoming more and more hopeless, and the people who were really anti-Brexit and were saying that there's a way out, that there's no way out, and it's just sad. And so he compares it a bit to these things that Lyndon Johnson said. He said, "I don't think it's worth fighting for, and I don't think we can get out. It's the biggest damn mess." That's what Lyndon Johnson said about the Vietnam War? No.
Yeah, the Vietnam War.
Yeah, the Vietnam
War.
That's
exactly what Lyndon Johnson said about the Vietnam War. But I think that's way over the top to compare.
No, here's what he says. He says, "Brexit is not a military atrocity, and there is no moral equivalence implied by comparison with Vietnam. Still, I sense that our incumbent Johnson is also trapped in the midway point of a longer tragedy, the premise of which are unable to grasp. That perspective will always elude the Prime Minister because he adheres to the 19th century view that history is made by great men and is enough of a narcissist to count himself among them." I think that is completely true. I think that Boris Johnson does think that history is made by great men, and that's why he idolises Churchill so much.
Yeah.
And he believes in this view that history is made by single men, and you know, and
all married men, yeah.
Pardon?
All married men, not just single men.
Oh, I didn't get what you were on about then at all. Went right over my head. That he believes that history and these romantic moments of decisions and whatever, and I don't think that's true at all. But I think that this article, I was like, it's really frustrating to read because it's, again, this kind of like catastrophic thinking of we're at this tragedy point. And I was like, I don't think I agree.
No, well, we don't know. That's the problem.
But this is the thing. We could be living in this moment that people read about in history books, and they'll look back on it and kids will study it and think, oh my God, how did they allow this to happen? Why didn't someone stop it? Mm. It could be just as easily this awful tragedy as it could be actually not that important.
Yeah. It seemed to me that what Theresa May proposed was the best possible deal and wasn't a half bad deal. We proposed quite a substantial divorce settlement, but that divorce settlement would be paid and then we wouldn't have to pay into the EU in theory it would have helped the kids, because by the time the economic, you know, by the time their mums and dads shitstorm was over and their businesses had suffered and all that, we would then get to the point where we paid the divorce bill and we weren't paying in it every year to the EU, which seemed to be one of the two things things that people objected to. There were outright racists who just didn't like foreigners. And then there were, or xenophobes, if you like. And then there were people who thought, well, we pay too much into the EU. Mm. We're just keeping this huge bureaucracy with the big parliaments in Strasbourg and Brussels going. Why should we be paying into that? You can see the
logic,
on a very simple level. So Theresa May's deal seemed to sort of solve that. And everything that Labour were whinging on about, the reasons they didn't like the deal, it didn't take care of workers' rights, we would get chlorinated chicken from America, you know, health, the environment, all that sort of stuff. It was all in there. It was all in Theresa May's deal.
Yeah.
So I think they shot them, Parliament shot them, and we should be ashamed of our MPs, so they shot themselves in the foot by not accepting that deal, which was probably about the best we could get.
Yeah. So he goes on to say, zoom out a little still further, and Brexit could look like the prelude to a wider unravelling. If the European project is rattled by financial crisis and fractured by vandalistic nationalism, had to look up vandalistic, obviously.
Well, vandals.
Yeah, that's what I meant, but
I mean, you've heard Bob Dylan, the vandals took the handles.
The debate will be whether Britain was wise to get out when it did. So he's making the argument that the EU is falling apart anyway, which was what a lot of people said at the time of Brexit, was that the EU's going to, you know, France don't want to be in the EU if we leave. That all sense
Italy,
be the ending.
Italy definitely doesn't want to be in the EU.
So was wise to get out when it did, or criminal in failing to stay at the critical juncture. One side will celebrate Brexit as a heroic leap from the fire escape. The other will deplore it as the arsonist spark that ignited an inferno.
Bit of music?
Yes, absolutely.
Should we start with mine?
Yeah.
Well, let's have a listen to it and see if you recognise the singer.
A bottle of white, a bottle of red, perhaps a bottle of rosé instead. Get a table near the street in our old familiar place. You and I, face to face. A bottle of red.
Oh, I do. It's not Paul McCartney.
No, it's not Paul McCartney.
No, wait, not John Lennon.
Oh, it's not John.
None of the Beatles.
It is not connected to the Beatles.
I know
whatsoever.
Who it is. Elton John.
No, but you're very much in the right ballpark.
Oh, I know who it is, though.
There was a period in the...
Can you give me a clue?
Yes, I will.
I recognise his voice loads.
Right. Well, there was a period in the mid to late 70s, early 80s, when that sort of singer-songwriter...
Billy Joel.
Correct!
Yes!
Billy Joel. Well,
I knew it! I could hear, because I love that... She's Always a Woman. I love that song. Mm. And I could hear that when he was singing that.
And Moving Out Today, like that.
Yeah.
Well, Billy Joel.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, well done. but you should put that on your playlist. You will absolutely love it. It's called Scenes from an Italian Restaurant. It was on a fantastic LP called The Stranger. And he was on, the other night, he was on the Stephen Colbert Late Show in America. You know, it's a chat show.
Is it not just Colbert?
Colbert.
Ah. Oh. I've been saying Colbert all over town.
Have you? Well, you can start saying Colbert now, because that's how he calls himself. Mm. So he was on that Stephen Colbert Late Show, and he was asked to pick the top five Billy Joel songs as chosen by Billy Joel, and that was his top song. So
wow.
Definitely put that on your playlist. Because I noticed when I was playing Moving Out, St. Anthony's song, you were very impressed.
Yeah,
with
I liked
Billy
it.
Joel. Yeah. The interesting thing was at the time.
I love that She's Always a Woman.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned.
Even though it's a bit.
You mentioned Elton John, who was in the same sort of area as piano playing singer songwriters as Billy Joel. Mm-hmm. Also in that area was Barry Manilow, who.
Oh, Barry Manilow. Excellent. Barry Manilow.
Dear.
Yeah,
really, you don't just have to be satirical. Well, the thing about Barry Manilow is when he started exactly the same time as Billy Joel, and when the two of them started, they were comparable. Barry Manilow wasn't considered to be this sort
jerk
of camp,
artist.
Jokey type thing.
Well, the thing is, though, with people like Billy Joel and Barry Manilow, that they're still popular today because music and passion is always in fashion. I was cooking that one up.
You've been cooking it up, haven't you? And we didn't do any preparation for this beforehand, as people will know. So, yeah, Billy Joel, anyway, born in the Bronx, New York City. And I know we always find it amusing when Americans try and do an English accent.
Yes.
Well, Billy Joel, I'm going to play you this bit because this is from the Colbert Show the other night, right? And Billy Joel was talking about the first gig he was aware of that he went to, which was Jimi Hendrix was playing New York in the 60s.
Wow.
And he got in without a ticket. And this is him
That's a pretty good first gig.
Yes, this is him talking about it. That's not it. This is him talking about
it. We didn't have tickets. It was with another guy who was in my band. And we snuck in by holding cables and, you know, just talking with English accents, Erzatz English accents. Jimmy's got to get his cables. He's going to be really pissed off. So we got to get to the stage. And I kind of bullcrapped my way up to the stage. And I was just talking with an English accent to all the promoters, security. And we got to the stage, and Jimmy's roadie, a road manager, was a guy named Keith Robertson, famous English roadie. He's been the roadie for every big English band. And he looked at me, he goes, "Come here, you. You're pretty good." And I was, "Am I? Thank you. And you're going to help load up Jimmy's amps." So there we are, carrying stacks of Marshall amps onto the stage, which was pretty cool. And I got to watch Hendrix from
He knew that you were just faking.
I was faking.
But he was like, "Fine, I'll put you to work."
He's a good fake. Good fun. Appreciate it.
So
I think it's quite a good English accent.
It's not bad, is it, really?
It's because it's very, like, regional, so it sounds less fake.
But they all do that sort of side London accent.
But it's also kind of a little bit Liverpool-y, wasn't it? Like that.
Well, maybe a little bit. When the Beatles was an animated series made in America, the Beatles all spoke
like Cockneys.
They did. Anyway, that's Billy Joel. Brilliant.
Right.
People know who Billy Joel is, so we don't need to explain.
Cool. Well, I've got a song called "Simmer" that's by Mahalia and featuring Burna Boy. We can find a place for your personal. Go down somewhere.
So nice and simple this week. "Simmer" by Mahalia. Mahalia?
Mahalia, I think.
Mahalia. But so go on, tell me about Mahalia.
So she is a singer she's only 21, and she's been around for quite a while, but she's from Birmingham. I first got introduced to her because her earlier stuff is much more kind of like folksy, like pretty acoustic-y type songs. And I went to a festival and saw her there when I didn't really know her songs and stuff, and she was brilliant. This is when she was probably only 18 or something, and she was amazing, and she has been. And then just recently, she's kind of been getting on the rise since then, and she's been getting more into like the hip-hop and the R&B side of things, and she was talking about sort of like body positivity and all that kind of stuff, like with like Radio 1, and I think that she'll get really, really big. But I think she's just great, really good.
Why is she talking about body positivity? She's sort of...
She's slightly curvier. She's not curvy, not really.
No, I watched the video thought, oh, she's slightly curvy.
We're always shown girls who are like stick thin.
Well, a couple of emails this week.
Good.
Mainly from cronies, I have to say. David Sherratt actually describes himself as a crony. Long-time listener, crony, he said. He said, "I've intended to write before with some generation gap dynamite material, but alas, it was all a bit moany," he says, and Victor Meldrew, who's a TV character, you know, who was always moaning about stuff. Ruth, congratulations with your A-level results. I'm sure I'm not alone here in podcast land to be pleased you've done so well.
Oh,
so well,
thanks.
Done. That's Dave Sherratt. Graham Potter sent me a very... he said this is for level testing, but...
Oh, Dad.
I see what you think. Astronaut 1, "Hi, mate, I can't find any milk for my coffee." Astronaut 2, "In space, no one can. Here, use cream." No one can. hear you scream. No one can hear you scream. It's a line from
No one can hear you scream. Yeah. In space, no one can hear you scream. Yes, yeah,
and I thought it might be a little bit involved to start the whole podcast with. But anyway,
it's often just not that funny.
And it's not that funny, Graham. So your child, there you go. So don't dare send us any more emails that aren't that funny.
No, please do, because we don't get enough.
Hugh Besant, who's also a crony, says, well, he was talking about, he said, your discussion about renting was interesting. Remember I said last week, and you said, well, if you're a rent, you're living there, you're not wasting all the money. I've rented for 10 years since divorce ate all my capital, and it's largely a positive experience, so I'll give you a short pros and cons list in no particular order. One, you don't have to do any DIY. If something breaks, you just call the landlord. Two, you know exactly what your outgoings are. None of the nasty surprises of owning property when you need a new boiler or something like that. Three, if you get bored, you can move. He says, I haven't, and it's a hassle, but it does give you a lot of flexibility, especially if you change jobs, that sort
of
thing.
That's a good point, yeah.
Four, you can end most cold calls instantly by saying, no, I'm just a tenant. These are the big buts. He says, you can be asked to leave. I love my flat, and it has changed hands twice during my time here, with me staying on as a tenant. But right now, the owner is desperate to sell, so it might go to someone else who wants to live here, and that will be a pain. So you can lose your place. You see.
Well, there's not the same security.
No. The cost, £760 a month. He's in the Surrey commuter belt for one bed. So I think balancing you're better off owning than...
I think my point was just that people do look at renting as like the devil, and I don't think it's the devil.
Well, here's something to watch out for when you go to university, Ruth, and that is Freshman Flush. Have you heard of Freshman Flush? Sounds like a character, doesn't it? Some sort of cartoon or sci-fi thing. But Freshman Flush is the feeling when that first maintenance payment pours into a student's bank account, almost begging to be spent. It's amazing how quickly a few £1,000 can disappear. So watch it on rent, bills, food and going out. So university isn't just about learning to live independently. It's about the challenge of managing your finances too. But we've talked, you're aware of all this, aren't you?
Yeah, I think so. It's just about budgeting and making sure you're not spending more money than you actually have.
The good news about student debt...
And nights out, don't spend a lot.
No.
I was talking to someone and they were like, the main thing you can do on a night out to avoid spending loads of money is drink beforehand and don't buy takeaways, just have a bowl of cereal when you get in. And I was like, that's actually quite a good tip, because you do end up spending like £8 on something that you don't really need.
Yeah, just to soak it. Yeah, if you're drunk, you'll buy
If you're drunk, you'll just buy a pizza.
A kebab or a pizza.
Yeah, but you don't need to just have a bowl of cereal when you get in.
Good. Well, I mean, you do that anyway, more or less, don't you?
Yeah, I'm not a massive night out eater.
No. And it's the
Buy a pizza, but... Or buy a pizza before you leave, and you can get one for like £1.50.
Mm.
Or cheaper.
No, it's not going to be... Don't buy
pizza. No, freezer one.
You don't buy a freezer pizza for £1. They're not good ones. The freezer
pizza. You know
pizzas,
what, though? I do think the ones that are not... So there's like three tiers, isn't there? There's like the Pizza Express ones, which are the like fancy ones. And then
are you talking about to put in your freezer?
The ones you buy at the supermarket.
Right.
Maybe more like the fridge ones.
So there are pizzas you buy at the supermarket.
Dad. Okay, there's actually four tiers. So I would say there's the freezer ones, the ones you actually buy in the freezer section, and then there's three separate fridge ones, and those are the ones we'll go into detail on. So you've got your bottom tier. No, you've got your top tier ones, which are your, like, Pizza Express branded pizzas.
Yeah.
Those are fancy.
Also,
the Sainsbury's Taste the Difference,
yes,
Tesco
precisely.
Finest. I don't know what the Asda fancy is.
Morrison's is the best.
The best, yeah.
I
don't know what
Asda
is. It's not one close by, really.
No, because I don't like the way Walmart treat their staff, so I never shop at Asda.
Right. Is it also, if the Sainsbury's in Wakefield was an Asda, you'd probably go there, though, wouldn't you?
Probably.
Yeah.
it's very handy with Asda, because Walmart, I think, everything you read about Walmart, you know, they are awful, and therefore there's no Asdas near us, so I can quite easily boycott Asda, because... They're nowhere near us.
Right.
Yeah.
Then your number two.
It's nice to be woke.
Your number two pizza. This is your second one.
Right. So we've got Tesco Finest and...
And also like the Pizza Express branded ones, which I would say are the best ones.
Yeah, I don't think they're any better than Tesco, the best,
good.
And Sainsbury's Taste the Difference.
I disagree.
Okay.
Or Aldi Deluxe. Those ones are good as well.
Well, you know my views on Aldi. I'm not a fan.
I know. You got your number two ones, which are... branded pizzas, but the supermarket brand, but not basics and not finest, just the standard brand, which I think are the best quality and value for money combined. Like, I think that's the best one. And also, sometimes those fancy pizzas, they've got too much on them for cooking in a normal oven. Like, the cheese doesn't melt as well. So I would say those are the best pizzas, the normal brand supermarket ones. Then you've got in your third tier the kind of ones you'd buy if you were having a party and having lots of people around and you didn't want to spend a lot of money. They in at Sainsbury's, they come in a yellow package and they're just really standard. Like, they're basic Sainsbury's basics or Morrison's
or Tesco Essentials. Tesco
Everyday Value.
Waitrose Essentials, Tesco Everyday Value.
No, it's not Tesco.
Tesco is Everyday Value.
I thought Asda was Everyday Value.
I don't know what Asda is because I...
Anyway, those are your bottom Asda ones. As you know. So I would say you want to go for that middle tier pizza.
Well, I would say for a pizza, you don't want a pizza that costs, in a supermarket,
I do
that
think
costs
they,
under
they,
about
they've
five,
come,
five quid.
What?
Yeah.
You're mental. Even those expensive ones cost
about
five quid.
About 4 or 5 quid.
No, that I would say they're 3.75 tops.
Yeah. Well, you're clearly well.
The price is right.
Yeah, you're absolutely well equipped to
go to uni. Yeah,
to
that's
to
all
uni.
You need to know, right?
Yeah. So you'll be eating pizza mainly. The good news about student debt is that none of it needs to be repaid while at university. The bad news is there may be a lot of it.
I worked out how much I had to earn. It was a disgusting figure. It was like 50 grand or something ridiculous.
What, before you start paying it back?
No. That was how much I was going to earn. No, I was going to earn about 60 grand, I think.
Oh, that's how much you have to earn.
Yeah.
Many of the poorest students, so this won't be you, leave with £57,000 of debt, according to the Institute
I'll leave,
for Fiscal
I'll leave with
Studies.
That. Because I'm doing 4 years.
Oh, you're doing 4 years?
And I'm getting a maintenance loan. That's... They shouldn't let the debt put off... poor students from going to university. Yeah. Martin Lewis says that. Martin Lewis was like, it needs to be rebranded. It's not a debt, it's a loan. And it's wrong. And politicians discourage poor people.
Just by using the word debt.
By using the word debt and by talking about the debt as this big, scary thing. And Martin Lewis, he was really passionate about it. And he was like, you're putting off disadvantaged students from going to university because of the way that you speak about it. And it's completely wrong.
But it's quite good that quite a lot of people are now going for apprenticeships.
That's good.
That has been a positive effect.
Oh, really positive. It's so much more suited to so many people as well. Yeah. Especially if you want to go into a trade, why go to university? There's no point.
You know, I'm always keen on not just being woke, you know, boycotting Asda and all that stuff, but also very keen on new slang, new ways of speaking. And there's a couple of things you've introduced me to over the years. Ghosting, you told me all about ghosting.
I heard of a thing the other day called love bombing.
Love bombing, what's that?
That was when, it's usually when men do it in a way to then become like manipulative later. Like, I'll look up the exact definition because I don't want to get it wrong. Love bombing is an attempt to influence a person by demonstrations of attention and affection. It can be used in different ways and can be used for either a positive or negative person. And it's often, you know, if... I think it's more common that men would do it, man would do it to a woman, where it's really early on in a relationship and they buy you, like, a really expensive gift and then...
So it's nothing to do with phones, it's to do with...
It's just general, like, relationship etiquette. And they buy you, like, a really expensive gift really early in the relationship, and then if they do something wrong, they'll say, oh, well, remember what I've done for you, like that kind of thing, which is obviously really manipulative.
Well, tell me if you've heard of any of these. Zombieing. Have you heard of zombieing?
Isn't that, like, ghosting a bit?
Assuming you can continue where you left off with someone you ghosted for a long time, so you ghost someone and then you try and get back with them.
Yeah.
That's a zombie, you know, because
when you message them.
I can see why it's called zombie.
Yeah. Re.
Breadcrumbing? Have you heard of breadcrumbing?
Is that like leaving, it must be like leaving little things like little Instagram stories
exactly.
and that kind of stuff.
Breadcrumbing, making sporadic flirtatious gestures, whether it's a like on Instagram or a suggestive text message, which is a breadcrumb, every couple of months, even though you have no intention of dating seriously. So you're doing
that's
that
not nice,
breadcrumbing
is it?
Thing. No. Benching, you heard of benching?
That must be having a roster of girls that you just switch in and out. and put some of them on the bench.
Like benching, it's
in a football game
context. Yes, absolutely. Regularly texting and calling, but never suggesting to meet up unless you need a backup date. So somebody's sitting on the bench. It's a substitute, really.
Mm-hmm.
Haunting.
Yeah, keeping someone on a string.
Yep.
Haunting.
What's that?
Like leaving them for a while and kind of ghosting them, and then every once in a while replying to a story.
Yeah, they all make sense, these. Haunting is getting back in
touch. They're just words for things that have...
Yes. Getting back in touch after a long period of silence in a non-committal way by following them on Twitter or watching their Snapchat stories. Stashing.
Well, that's like, what is orbiting? You've heard about the orbiting thing.
You did say that before. Yeah. Stashing.
Nope.
So you can introduce these now. Stashing is when you don't...
I will be using all of these.
It's when you don't introduce them to friends or family and leave no trace of your romance on social media. Instead, you keep the relationship a secret in the same way that you'd stash away old tracksuit bottoms that are too comfortable to get rid of. So stashing. So you do...
Okay, so in a drawer.
Yeah. Sidebarring.
Sidebarring. So the sidebar on a computer is like where you put notifications or something like that.
Sidebar on a newspaper piece is the little thing they put down the side.
Ah, a newspaper. What is this you speak of?
Yes. When in the middle of a date, you get your phone out and text a friend, reply to a WhatsApp message, etc.
Oh.
That's a sidebar.
I don't like that one as much. No. I think some of the other ones better.
R-bombing. The letter R. It's letting the blue tick show on WhatsApp.
Oh, red.
To prove you've read their message, but not replying.
Oh.
That's really bad, is it? So this is like,
I mean, I don't use... No one under the age of 26 uses WhatsApp or whatever.
Don't they?
No.
No one under the age of 26 uses WhatsApp.
No one under the age of 26 uses WhatsApp.
Apart from the family WhatsApp.
Apart from family.
So what are you using these days?
Snapchat, Instagram.
I use Twitter, but not to chat to people. No.
Snapchat and Instagram.
Twitter to raise your profile in immediate
sense. It's my professional capacity.
Yeah. Well,
follow me, at Ruth Kellner 1.
Ruth Kellner 1, at Ruth Kellner 1. Follow her. She's on Twitter. I thought you didn't like all that. Just finish before we go into your meme. Do you have a meme this week?
Yes.
Before we go into your meme, a little quiz.
I like a quiz.
Yeah, well, it's a quiz about Hollywood. Apparently, in Hollywood these days, the key way to get a part is to have a vast number of followers on social media.
Mm.
Beyonce, Taylor Swift and Rihanna have all been cast in some of Hollywood's biggest movies, despite having no formal training as actors. Last year, Rihanna turned up in the Ocean's 8 reboot. Pretty soon we'll see Beyonce as Nala in the remake of The Lion King. That's happened now.
I've still not seen it.
And Taylor Swift has been cast in the Cats film. You know, you said you were excited about seeing it. It's an animation film, isn't it, of Cats? And the reason for that is that on Instagram alone, each of them has a larger fan base than the entire UK population.
Wow.
So that's over 60 million. So I'm going to go between these people... And tell me who of these four people you think has the most Instagram followers.
Okay.
Right? Taylor Swift.
Okay.
Beyonce. Selena Gomez. And Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
I think I know this.
Go on then.
I think it's Selena Gomez.
Not bad.
I think Selena Gomez has the most ever on the whole
Spot
of Instagram.
On, 152 million.
Yeah, she's got the most out of...
Three times the population of the UK, almost.
She has the most Instagram followers in the world.
Yeah, she does. All right, I'll go further down. Between Ellen DeGeneres and Rihanna, who do you think would have the most Instagram followers?
Rihanna, I think.
Or the more Instagram followers. No, Ellen DeGeneres has 74 million. Rihanna has 73 million.
Wow.
Yep. So let's go to Twitter now, see how they're all doing on Twitter. Is Selena Gomez still top on Twitter? So who has the most Twitter followers in the world? Do you want to give you a choice of
people? You can have to give me a choice because I really don't know.
Right. The most Twitter followers in the world. It's between Jennifer Lopez, Taylor Swift, Miley Cyrus and Oprah Winfrey.
Oh, that's really hard. So I don't think it's Jennifer Lopez.
No.
Because... she's just not famous enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think Taylor Swift will have a lot. But I don't think it's Oprah. But Miley Cyrus, she'll have a lot as well. And she tweets a lot. I'm going to go Miley Cyrus.
No, it's Rihanna.
You didn't give me an option of Rihanna, though.
I didn't.
It's hard to game. It's not a choice. Right.
My apologies. All right, then. We'll do another a quick one, then. This is the last one. It's a very quick one. Who has the most Twitter followers, Harry Styles or Oprah Winfrey?
Harry Styles.
No. Oprah Winfrey
has... I knew that. I don't know why I said Harry Styles.
Oprah Winfrey has 42 million. Still a lot of Twitter followers. Mm-hmm. Harry Styles has 33 million.
He's still doing well.
Yes. And
he's okay.
I have 28,000. But
I'm you're close to 29,000, are you?
Close to 29,000. Meme of the week.
Yeah. This is just a tweet. I just thought it was quite funny. The slug and lettuce bar is just Wetherspoons for dickheads.
That's not bad. That's very similar to...
I just thought it was just good.
Very similar to that line about the orange lemonade that was in After Hours. That
San Pellegrino.
Yeah,
it's just Fanta for dickheads.
Yeah, San Pellegrino, just Fanta for dickheads.
Yeah, that was a really good... That was the best line in that whole series.
Not one of my lines. Ooh. I did play Barry B in that series, and I'm still waiting for the call.
I thought it was really good. I'm surprised it didn't.
It didn't get
not enough people watched it, I don't think. No. But it was really.
Yeah. We're talking about After Hours, Craig Cashie's sitcom on Sky One.
Yeah. Young people, sort of.
Running what around. Was this about 5 years ago, was it, I suppose?
Yeah, maybe not quite as long as that, but yeah. I think that brings us to a close.
I was about to say the very same thing. That's it for this week. If you want to get in touch with us, and we do like to get the emails, not just from my cronies, but anybody who wants to send us an email, we'd love to get it. It's Martin and Ruth Podcast, obviously all one word, Martin and Ruth Podcast at gmail.com.
Martin and Ruth Podcast at gmail.com. And you can also go on the Spotify, to not only listen to the podcast, but you can also listen to the songs from this week in full and all the others on our Spotify playlist. And we are at Ruthie, Me and My Dad, or Martin and Ruth, either of those searches, and you'll find it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.